The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey folks, I challenge you to think of at least one thing you no longer do that you wish you could. Do you miss like playing golf, maybe long walks with your spouse, sleeping through the night? Are you ready to start living without pain? My colleagues and friends, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Mike Gallagher, have been talking about their own successful experience with Relief Factor, and you can add Eric Metaxas to that list. Relief Factor is changing the lives of tens of thousands of Salem radio listeners by reducing and even eliminating daily aches and pains. ReliefFactor.com is full of great success stories, and now I am on board. For just $19.95, Relief Factor is offering a three-week quick start that could help you live your life with little to no pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com to see testimonials from folks all over the country. I love reading them. Over 70% of those that try Relief Factor continue as a customer. Feel the relief and get back your independence and freedom from the aches and pains of everyday life. Go to ReliefFactor.com. Read the testimonies. I tell all my relatives to take it. ReliefFactor.com.
Folks, I've met a lot of people in my life named Eric. My mailman's named Eric. The guy that cleans my pool is named Eric. And truth be told, I used to be named Eric myself. But Eric, you know who, didn't like me being another Eric, too, and said if I wanted to be his announcer, I had to change my name to Todd. Ugh, I hate the name Todd. What parent would ever name their kid Todd? It's so generic. But I needed the money, my kids gotta eat, and now the other Eric, Eric Metaxas.
Oh, boo-hoo, Todd. Tell it to the judge. I've got business to do. I'm sitting here in the studio with my friend Mike Brown, PhD. Mike Brown, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Eric.
Yes, I don't have a real PhD. I have several honorary PhDs, which you know, that and 250 will get you a latte.
Well, it depends how many honoraries, because that can and where they're from.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Albin gave me one. But that was kind of like for a birthday present. It was. Made it up himself.
I was made an honorary redneck several years ago in Tennessee.
Is that true?
Yeah, and I got an honorary inner city something in the Bronx a few years ago. I forget what that was.
I have five, a Bronx cheer.
Could be.
No.
I was made something.
All right. I want to give people your. First of all, we're going to talk about your book. The book is Resurrection: Investigating a Rabbi from Brooklyn, a Preacher from Galilee, and an Event That Changed the World. You have written all kinds of books. We've had you on this program before, but I always want people to get your background because you've got such a fascinating background. You were raised as a secular Jew on Long Island.
Yeah, so born in New York City, raised on Long Island. My dad was a senior lawyer in the New York Supreme Court. Mom and dad happily married. I was bar mitzvahed at 13, but it was really a social event. So, you know, we were nominal in that respect. Being Jewish, we knew it had meaning to us, but it was fairly nominal. So when I was bar mitzvahed at 13, you know, I had to chant a portion of scripture from the Hebrew Bible. I didn't even know what I chanted. And no one even thought of telling me, Michael, you should read this passage here and read it in English and meditate on it. It was more getting through the ritual.
I had a very similar experience in the Greek Orthodox Church, except I had to recite Greek and they didn't tell me what it was.
Yeah, so that was the extent of our spirituality, the way we grew up. The bigger event that impacted me at 13 was seeing Jimi Hendrix in concert.
Get out.
Yeah, because I was playing.
What do you need God for if you saw Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah, so.
Come on.
So 8 years old, I started playing drums. 9 years old, the Beatles came to America. 13 years old, I see Hendrix in concert. 14, someone asked me if I wanted to get high, and I thought, well, you know, the rock stars do it. Plus, you're not supposed to do this kind of thing, so that gave it a certain appeal. It's illicit. So I started getting high at 14, but I had a high resistance to drugs, so it took me more drugs, harder drugs to get high. So I started doing other drugs very quickly, and by the time I was 15, I was shooting heroin. And I was known in my high school as Iron Man and Drug Bear because I was such a heavy drug user. And I was quite proud of what I was doing. I was decadent and proud about it and thought I was cool and playing drums and going to these rock concerts day and night and stuff. And, you know, from Zeppelin to Grateful Dead to all the bands of the day, The Doors, The Who. And that was my life. My two best friends, band members, like these two girls, hung out with them. Little by little, the girls started getting drawn to God. They had an uncle who was a pastor. Dad was praying for them.
This is enough to harsh my mellow right now.
Yeah, so what happens is they start going to the church services. My friends start getting drawn in. And initially, they're just going and they find it fascinating because it's a Pentecostal church, right? So we're teenage drug users. You know, they believe in tongues. What's that? Angels, demons, they pray for the sick. Like, are you serious? But then the pastor was teaching a lot on the end times and teaching on the book of Revelation. So my friends come home from a church service. Remember, they're not saved yet. We're sitting around getting high, and they're telling me, yeah, Mike, there's going to be a beast with seven heads and 10 horns. I remember sitting there.
And according to Hal Lindsey, it's this weekend.
Yeah, and it was that weekend back then, right? Yeah. So we're think this is fascinating, but then little by little, God started to change my friends. So I went to pull them out. The first service I attended.
Wait. You went to the church to pull them away from God.
Yeah, I was going to go there and show them the whole thing is stupid and it's idiotic and you shouldn't believe in it. August of 71, one of those two sisters who knew me from high school wrote down in her diary, Antichrist comes to church. True. Yeah. So that, I mean, I was not just a drug user.
So you were perceived as a tool of Satan.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. We don't want to judge. We know there's a lot of people who listen to this program.
Well, actually, I've been accused of being a tool of Satan within recent weeks by hypercritics. But anyway, but that happens.
I think it's a badge of honor. At some point, if you're not accused of that, you're not walking right.
But then I was. Then I was a tool of Satan because I was trying to pull my friends away, and I was a wicked, rebellious, mean, angry kid. So what I didn't know was that the people in that church started praying for me. And when I went that night, maybe 40, 50 people there, but they were so loving and sweet. I thought, okay, you have your religion. You're doing what you're doing. I'll do what I'm doing. They started praying for me. I didn't know they were praying for me, but the Holy Spirit started to convict me. I mean, one day I'm boasting about the idiotic things I do, even stole money from my own father, shamefully. And I'm boasting about this to my friends. Now I'm laying in bed at night. I can't sleep because I feel so miserable. And November of 71, I went back to a church service. And at the end of the service, they said, okay, if anyone here wants to receive Jesus, they did it every night. Didn't matter if it's the same people. So my friend nudges me like, you should go up. And I thought, you know, these old people get a kick out of it because, you know, they think I'm like the worst sinner in the world. If I go up there and pray this prayer, they'll get a big kick out of it. I didn't mean anything by it. But my friends had been sharing the gospel with me day and night, and we had been talking through the issues. When I went up and the pastor asked me to say these words, I said, you know, I do believe Jesus died for me. I do. And I do believe he rose from the dead, but I'm not willing to change. I'm not willing to give up the way I'm living. So that launched a battle. I mean, I prayed that night, God, if you don't want me to shoot cocaine and do these other drugs, when I do it, don't let it have any effect. And I went home and smoked a large quantity of what was called PCP or angel dust and then shot a lot of cocaine and nothing happened. And I thought, okay, something's up here. So one day I'm shooting heroin, next day I'm in church, back and forth for 5 weeks. And then December 17th, 71. Now remember, I'm living at rock concerts. I'm playing with our band. The favorite song of our band was called Dance of the Mushroom Men, if that gives you a little feel. And again, I'm seeing Hendrix again, and 10 years after, and Jethro Tull, and the volume, the intensity of the music so loud. Now I'm in this little church, and they're playing hymns. The pastor's wife at the piano playing hymns like Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine, There's Power in the Blood. As they're playing and we're singing these hymns, I get overwhelmed with a joy I've never known. And I thought, this is different than drugs. This is different than music. This is different than sports. This is different than friendship. This must be what they call the joy of the Lord. And at that moment, I got a revelation of God's love. I saw myself as if I was filthy from head to toe, and Jesus washed me clean and put beautiful white robes on me, and I was going back playing in the mud. And I said, God, I will never put a needle in my arm again. December 17th of 71 was free from that night on. And my dad, when he saw I was off drugs and I was really changed, he said, Michael, that's great, but we're Jews. We don't believe this. You need to talk to the rabbi, local rabbi. And then the local rabbi and I struck up a friendship, and then that led to years of dialogue and me getting into Hebrew in college, majoring in Hebrew, getting a doctorate in Semitic languages. And in fact, my newest book, some of it goes all the way back to rabbis that I met in 1973. But That's the amazing grace that I experienced.
Well,
in my life.
I wanted my audience, because I know, you know, some people tune in to this program that they haven't heard you before. But your story, I heard your story at Times Square Church, where I met my current wife, Sweetie. What's your name, honey? I always use that joke just to, you know, keep her on edge. But the fact of the matter is, we met at Times Square Church, and I remember they would bring in these different pastors. And when I heard you, I thought, wow, to hear your story, it's very powerful, because it's it speaks to, you know, our generation. I mean, the drugs, the everything. But you've written so many books, Mike. I want to get to the one that you're talking about, that you have right now. It's called Resurrection, Investigating a Rabbi from Brooklyn, a Preacher from Galilee, and an Event That Changed the World. Now, the Rabbi from Brooklyn, it looks like the Rebbe Schneerson,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So this is wild stuff, because he was alive not that long ago, and they were talking about him. He's the Moshiach, and it turns out maybe not. But tell us, you know, what led you to write this book?
So when I first met the rabbis from this particular group, the Lubavitchers, so
right.
ultra-Orthodox Jews that came over to New York
right.
Decades ago, when I met them, they would talk about the Rebbe, the Grand Rabbi. And he was a miracle worker, and he was, you know, brilliant, and all these things.
And this is Schneerson.
Schneerson.
You know what? We got to go to a break. Folks, that's called a cliffhanger. Do not go away. Folks, you may recognize that song as Free Bird, and you'll know that we can't play the whole thing because it's 11 minutes long, and the whole segment that we're doing is 11 minutes long. I'd really rather talk to my friend Mike Brown. The new book is called Resurrection. You were just telling us about Rabbi Schneerson in Brooklyn. This is kind of a crazy thing for people who aren't in the New York area, but that there's this huge Lubavitcher community in Brooklyn, and they actually seem to believe that Schneerson, who was like in his 90s, was the Messiah.
Yeah, so when I first met their rabbis in 1973, then they were talking a lot about the Messiah, but not talking so much about him being the Messiah. There were banners saying, when will the Messiah come? And Rabbi Schneerson had done something different. He was sending out emissaries called Shluchim, sending them out to other Jewish communities to try to get people to be more Jewish. They had what was called mitzvah mobiles, mitzvah's commandments.
I've seen these. These are the funniest things ever.
Yeah,
there was one driving up 6th Avenue the other day, a mitzvah mobile. Tell the audience, because you won't believe this.
Yeah, so this is going on to this day. So you'll have these trucks, and the back is open, you know, and they'll stand on the street and say, "Mister, you Jewish?" Yeah, okay.
And I get that all the time.
Right, and then if you're Jewish, they'll ask if you put on tefillin, if you prayed the certain prayers during the day and put on the phylacteries. No, well, come on, do it. And their hope is that it'll spark something. It'll spark something Jewish in you to want to be more observant. So as he got older, and as the movement grew, and as they said, the Messianic era is getting closer and closer, and he was the seventh in the seventh generation of rabbis that came from this one leader. And there was speculation that the seventh generation was the Messianic era.
Who was the leader from which he sprang?
Shneur Zalman. Yeah, and he's famous for writing Talmud, Tanya. And anyway, so that's the distinctive of these Lubavitcher Hasidic Jews. So he was the seventh in descended from him. And neither he or his wife could have children, so there are no children, no successor. As he's getting older, they begin to wonder, maybe he's the Messiah. Could he be the Messiah? And then he has two terrible strokes in his 90s, so he can't talk now. And they're now, he's the Messiah. He's definitely, he's about to reveal himself. He's going to be glorified. And then he dies. 1994, at the age of 92, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson dies. To this day, if you go to the Lubavitcher headquarters, 770 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, and go in the synagogue there, they are proclaiming him as the Messiah. Now, the movement as a whole, which is spread worldwide and is the most influential Jewish movement in the world, they continue to grow and they continue to educate and try to get Jews to become traditional. The majority outward view says he could have been the Messiah, but he wasn't the Messiah. But if you go into the synagogue there, they'll say, oh, yeah, he's spiritually present with us now. They pray prayers proclaiming him as the Messiah. Some even pray to his picture and things like that. And what prompted me to write this book, because now it's 2019 was the 25th anniversary of his death, and they're still proclaiming him as the Messiah. You can go into Israel and you'll see signs, and there it is in Hebrew, proclaiming him as King Messiah. Picture this old rabbi. You can go to the
I just have to ask you some questions. We have the time here because it's fascinating to me. Why is it that centuries of Judaism pass without any particular focus on Messiah? And then suddenly in the 70s, there's this focus on, we think he's coming soon, we think he's coming soon.
So on the one hand, Jews would pray every day, I believe in the coming of the Messiah, and even though he tarries, I'm going to believe every day that he's going to come. But Judaism through history got really burned with false messiahs. In the second century, there was Bar Kokhba.
And who can forget Bar Kokhba?
Well, he led the rebellion against Rome, right?
I've heard of Bar Kokhba.
Okay, so 132.
The son, I believe, of Kokhba.
Yeah, so that was the name they gave him, Bar Kokhba, son of the star, going back to Numbers, the 24th chapter. After his death, they changed it to Bar Kozeva, son of a lie, son of deception. But he was widely hailed as the Messiah, and he was going to lead the revolt against Rome. Instead, they got crushed and decimated and exiled from Jerusalem. Miserable. Then if you fast forward into the 1600s, you have Shabbatai Tzvi called the Mystical Messiah. And I've got a chapter on him. One of the most crazy, bizarre, wild stories you could ever imagine. And yet it's true. And it keeps getting more and more wild. And yet it's all true. So I tell that story as well. But that was a massive disaster and massive disappointment. So while there was speculation about the Messiah and praying for the Messiah, because they got burned with these false messiahs, it was going to take a lot to recognize someone as the Messiah. But after the Holocaust, after the horrors of the Holocaust, and then the rebirth of the State of Israel, there was more of a sense that the end is getting closer. And then because of the mysticism of this particular group and their belief about the seventh generation will be the Messianic era.
The Lubavitchers.
The Lubavitchers, right. And he's a miracle worker and he's a prophet and he's spreading the word of the Lord around the world and no one's done what he's done. Maybe he could be the Messiah. In the days before cell phones, remember people would wear beepers, right?
Yeah, those are your drug addict friends. My friends didn't wear beepers, but go ahead.
Well, in the drug addict days, we didn't have beepers, so this is much
later. Actually, this is the 80s drug addicts.
Oh, okay, got it. They wore beepers?
Well, the pushers did.
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah.
So the Lubavitcher, around the world, they would have beepers. And the reason for the beepers was the Rebbe's about to reveal himself as Messiah.
You're serious?
Oh, yeah, and they had a 1-800 Moshiach hotline you could call for the latest
1-800
update.
1-800-Moshiach?
Yeah, whatever.
But what if you misspell Moshiach?
Then you probably get some Buddhist or Hindu line, something like that. So what happened was anticipation. He's the man. Now he's had strokes. He's going to manifest himself. Well, he doesn't. Then he dies. And I had a friend of mine was there the day that he died. And he watched as the funeral procession came by. There were women that had tambourines in their hands because they were waiting for him to get up. They were waiting for him to rise. And then they could rejoice. Well, of course, he didn't. The mourning, the wailing. Well, there were people that camped out by his gravesite convinced that he would rise. Okay?
Now, this is interesting to me because, you know, I'm aware that in Jesus' day, of course, the concept of Messiah rising from the dead was a foreign concept. I mean, the disciples didn't get it.
Yep.
So how is this that, you know, 19, 20 centuries later, you have this expectation of a Messiah rising from the dead? Are they sort of halfway borrowing that from the Christian story?
Of course, they would deny it. And you had leading professors like Professor David Berger here in New York City. And he would say they're borrowing from Christianity because they did have the traditional Jewish teaching that the death of the righteous atones for the generation. I said, I'm going to tell you what they're going to do. When he dies, they're going to say his death atoned for the sins of the generation. Then they're going to talk about his resurrection. And sure enough, that's what happened. So it created a great conflict in Jewish circles. To me, God planted the concept there to ultimately point these very people to the risen Messiah. And here's the whole thesis of this book. And how I actually got to write it is a wild story, too. But here's the whole thesis of this book. We've been told for centuries, well, you know, there are other answers and explanations for the resurrection. And cognitive dissonance. People didn't really want to believe that it happened. They didn't. So you go into denial.
Right.
And then people say, well, will you die for a lie and concoct a lie that your guy rose? You're going to die for it later? But no, if you convince yourself cognitive dissonance, all right, these guys, the followers of the Rebbe, were the perfect candidates for this because they said he's going to rise. They were camping out at the grave waiting for him to rise. They were sure that he was the Redeemer, that he was the Messianic King, and all of this. And they proclaim him, many of them, as Messiah to this day, yet none of them say that they saw him physically rise. None of them say we sat physically and ate with him and talked with him. None of their leading rabbis. Whereas in the New Testament, it's the exact opposite. When Jesus dies, it's over. They're depressed. They're in fear. They have no expectation of a resurrection. When the first reports come from the women, they still don't believe it. So we now have a test case to look at this whole theory. And that's what I open up in the book. The whole cognitive dissonance, all the explanations that supposedly concocted the resurrection, they didn't happen here. They didn't happen in the 1600s at Shabbatai Tzvi because death is final. Death is certain. So you could say, well, we're still in touch. We have spiritual communion. Or I talk to my dead spouse every day, you know. But no one is talking about physical resurrection because it doesn't happen. And in the New Testament, all the accounts and the disciples' unbelief, you don't write that about your leaders. You don't write stuff that makes them to be fools and slow to believe. That's what Jesus says to two of them, oh, foolish and slow to believe what the prophets have written. It's only when they see with their own eyes. Thomas says, unless I see him, I'm still not going to believe it. That is one of the dynamic proofs of the reality of the accounts.
Well, that's one of the things I've said many times is that everyone knows that people don't rise from the dead. So if someone rises from the dead, that's called a miracle. There's no other way. It's just not something that happens. And to pretend that 2,000 years ago was so far ago, we're not talking 50,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, people weren't that different from the way they are today.
Nope.
They knew this didn't happen. So if it happened, this was an outrageous miracle designed to freak people out and to get them to say something has happened that has never happened in the history of the world. We're going to be right back. I'm talking to Michael Brown. The new book is called Resurrection.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw.
Did he say red-eyed cows? I wonder if he's talking about them red heifers. You familiar with the red heifers?
Never heard of it.
Yeah, I know. If anybody knows about the Red Heifer Project, it's Mike Brown, PhD. But we're talking about your book, Resurrection. You know, it's interesting, Mike, because one thing that I have noticed since I got serious about Jesus is that many Christians, born-again Christians, especially Pentecostal Christians, they're ignorant of the history. Like, you know, some people think that Christianity started with Calvin or with Luther. They forget that there's 15 centuries before that. Others think that, you know, Christianity magically came down in 1906 at Azusa Street, and before that it was all apostates. And I also think that we tend to be ignorant of the Jewish story. I mean, when you hear about, you know, what we know is the religion of Jesus was Judaism. It wasn't Christianity. And how that evolved once they had effectively rejected their Messiah. And so for you to go into that in this book, it is important that we understand this concept of Messiah from a Jewish perspective. So I'm grateful for that. Where were we when we just went to the break? We were talking about...
Well, we're talking about the fact that resurrection really happens.
Right.
That
right.
Other religions, they don't have it about their leaders, that they physically rose from the dead. And that you could have Islam without Muhammad rising. You could have Buddhism without Buddha rising. You could have Judaism without Moses rising. But we can't have our faith without the Savior rising. And that's the whole bedrock of it. And for the disciples in the first century, they weren't expecting it. I mean, think of it. If I said, yeah, and here, Eric, here's what's going to happen next. Jesus is going to come in the clouds of glory, you know, riding on a white horse. Then he's going to be shot down and killed. And then he's going to rise. It's like, what do you mean shot? What do you mean killed? What do you mean? That was their mentality then. They were not expecting a suffering, crucified Messiah. And as much as Yeshua would talk to them and say, I'm going to die and I'm going to rise, like, you're not going to die, Jesus, you're not going to die. You're the Messiah. And then even if they accepted that he was going to die, they couldn't figure out what he meant by rise from the dead, because it was just the thing didn't click for them. So when we see the accounts in the New Testament that have that absolute ring of credibility, when we see that here you have a fervent Jewish group that over 25 years after the death of their leader, many of the most devout followers, on their calendar, they do not have it as his death. They say it was a test for our physical eyes. They don't celebrate this particular day on Tammuz in June. They don't.
So to this day, 25 years after the death of Schneerson, they somehow insist that he really was the Messiah, he is the Messiah, and something will happen.
Yeah, and they either say that he didn't die, his death was a test for our physical eyes, or he spiritually rose. Some will say, well, if you go to the grave, you won't find anything in there. But again, nobody in their movement, not the leaders, not the thousands and thousands of fervent followers, said, no, we saw him rise. And what's the New Testament account? That he was with the disciples for 40 days after his resurrection, that at one point 500 people saw him. You can't just concoct this in the memory of people that lived when he lived.
And where Schneerson is buried someplace in Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, yeah.
Can we exhume him?
Well,
just you and me, you know, with a lantern.
Probably not. But tell you what, if you do it, you let me know.
Okay.
You let me know the results.
But I mean, the idea is that his bones lie in that grave, but so there are people claiming that they don't.
Yeah, but it's all. But no one ever claimed to have witnessed him risen from the dead, and
right. That's
what's so significant. Now, here's something else interesting. You got people camping out, waiting for him to rise. You've got people to this day saying, oh, he's in the room. He just came in the room. All these spiritual beliefs, but none of them even hallucinated that he rose. It's fascinating, and I quote a lot of the research in the book that people have done these long-term psychological studies, and you do not have mass hallucinations of resurrection from the dead.
Right.
And Eric,
except Biden's campaign.
Yeah, I did write and talk about the resurrection of Joe Biden as well.
That's pretty incredible.
But he
looks almost alive when you look at him. It's fascinating. It's a simulacrum of life.
I would just leave that
I'm trying to drag you into the political conflict.
I'm in the political conflict day and night, man. I finally get to talk about this.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. I have written, as you know, 5 volumes on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. I've debated rabbis for years. You've been at some of the debates.
Yes, I have.
And on the front lines of Jewish apologetics. But I never focused on resurrection because I thought, you know, Christian scholars have done that. You've got great Christian scholars, top guys, Gary Habermas, Mike Lacona, so many. They've written on the resurrection. Let them handle it. And I was talking to a couple of young Messianic Jewish brothers, some, you know, up-and-coming scholars, and talking to them about this. And they were talking about resurrection and using it as an apologetic. And I thought, why haven't I done that? All these years, I've let the Christian apologists do this. And when I tied it in with the Rebbe, I just finished reading another biography about him and the whole movement and all this. And think, on the calendar, the most devout, on the day of his death, they do not have it down as the day of his death because they don't want to acknowledge he died. For us, the death of the Messiah is the bedrock of our faith, his death and resurrection. We don't deny it. We don't downplay it. We don't say it didn't happen. We say he did die. He was crucified. And all our guys ran in fear. And then he rose from the dead. And he's alive today, not in the Joe Biden sense, but in the sense of working miracles. To this day, you wrote about it. Miracles being worked in Jesus' name to this day because he is risen.
We're going to go to another break. We're going to return with Michael Brown, the new book, kind of timely since we're looking at Easter Resurrection Sunday coming up. Resurrection is the title. We'll be right back.
Sun-streaking coat, a
We're playing a little Jethro Tull for our friend Mike Brown. Actually, Mike, we play it even when you're not here.
They were actually, before I would say, my favorite band to see in concert.
Jethro Tull?
Saw them four times at the Fillmore East.
Yeah. I believe the Holy Spirit is monkeying with our music today. That's very interesting.
But that was before I was saved.
That was before you were saved? Well, so what? Hey, look, good music is good music. You don't need to be high on the wacky weed to appreciate Jethro Tull. Right?
Yeah, some of the music.
Okay.
Well, I mean, not every Jethro Tull song is exactly Christian radio appropriate.
That's about the only one that I'll listen to. It. This is not Christian radio. This is radio.
Radio. This is radio.
Okay, just radio.
This is transcendent radio.
All right? I have the ungodless on this program just as often as I'll have the... No, I'll have the godless on. It's just as awful. I'll have the ungodless like you.
Like me.
I want to ask you about, you talk about this as a test case. This is actually fascinating because we often talk about when an ultra scientist and a scientistic scientist is talking about it's not reproducible, therefore science can't comment on it. That's nonsense because there's all kinds of things. When you go into a court of law, you know, you can't reproduce the murder and you can't do that kind of thing. So sometimes you have to come to conclusions outside of what we call strictly the scientific method. And people have been doing that since the beginning of time and it's accepted. But in this case, you have something like an experiment, and you're setting this up that, okay, this thing happened with Jesus 2,000 years ago. We've never had anything similar until Rabbi Schneerson dies in 1994, and now we can look at it as you're saying. That's kind of amazing to me.
Yeah, so here's what you have. You have a movement that looks to their leader, a Jewish movement, right, with devout Jewish followers. They look to their leader as a miracle worker and a unique vessel sent by God. They come to believe that he's the Messiah, and then in both cases, he dies. But in the case of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, there is the expectation that he's still going to manifest himself as the Messiah. So he's either going to rise from the dead, or something else is going to happen. You're going to find out he didn't really die. So that's what they are expecting. Jewish movement believing their leader is a miracle-working rabbi who's actually the Messiah, but he dies. They're not expecting his death. That doesn't fit in with their scenario. Well, if he dies, he's going to have to rise. The one rabbi, Rabbi Yeshua, tells his disciples he's going to rise. They don't believe it. They're depressed, fearful, hopeless, ready to just go back to their old way of life because their dreams are shattered. To their absolute shock and amazement, he rises from the dead, and they go on dying for their faith because they saw him, they were with him after his resurrection. Here, this other movement, they're expecting him to rise. Some deny that he even died. 25 plus years later, they're still saying he's the Messiah, but none of them claiming that he rose from the dead. You've got a test case now where you've got literally several hundred thousand potential candidates because this is the great speculation and the great belief. And what last time I was flying out of Israel at the airport in Tel Aviv, Lubavitch has a booth there and you can go over and put phylacteries on, fill in and say a prayer and so on. And I look there, there's the literature. He believes that the Rebbe's the Messiah, the guy right there. The headquarters in Brooklyn, they still proclaim it.
This is actually very interesting, Mike. I've never thought about this before. But it's a fascinating. It's one thing to say I'm a Jew. I believe in what Jews have always believed. But for that many Jews today to say they believe that this man who died in 1994 is Messiah, that's a little crazy, if I may say so. In other words, there's something. They're out on a limb in the way that you would never. I guess because this hasn't been publicized that much, but that's a. You know, that's a big meatball hanging out there to say that this guy that died 25 years ago is the Messiah predicted in the Bible.
Yeah, so here's the other interesting thing. The movement as a whole has moved away from it because of the embarrassment of it, because he didn't actually rise, because he did physically die. So they still look to him. The movement continues to grow as an Orthodox Jewish movement around the world. But the majority of the movement, this is the other interesting test case, they've had to move away from proclaiming him as the Messiah because he didn't rise, because the ones that still hold to it are considered to be fanatical.
Okay.
Or so they that is in the movement, and many even secretly believe it, but they can't publicly proclaim it because he didn't rise. And
right.
It's ludicrous. The fact that our movement grows and explodes by the thousands, the tens of thousands, to the millions, even though, hang on, he doesn't just die, he dies a criminal's death. utterly shameful in the Roman world that your leader dies by crucifixion, the worst punishment of all reserved for slaves and foreigners and insurrectionists and things like that. So that's at the heart of our faith. We don't deny his death. We proclaim his death and we proclaim his resurrection. So you have the complete opposites in terms of what actually happened. Those that have to go on claiming, you know, yeah, we still believe he's the Messiah, but the movement as a whole moves away from it. And then none of them attesting to resurrection. And when I tell the story in the book about Shabbatai Tzvi in the 1600s, which is an even wilder story, with all the things they believe, and maybe we'll have time to get into it, but with all the things his followers believed, and as far as it went, he actually converted to Islam to save his life, and they followed him by converting to Islam. And there are still secret followers of Shabbatai Tzvi within the Muslim world to this day. None of them claim that he rose from the dead.
The things I learned on my own radio program, is kind of incredible. I would love to talk to you about, how do you say it?
Shabbatai Tzvi.
Shabbatai Tzvi.
Shabbatai Tzvi.
Shabbatai Tzvi. When we're gonna go to a break in a little bit, and then we'll come back with you in hour two. But the book Resurrection, you talk about the resurrection in it, and I presume you help people who are doubtful about the actuality of the physical resurrection.
Oh yeah.
To believe in it.
Yeah, so it's a great book to give to a Jewish friend. I just met two Jewish men came to hear me speak in Georgia Sunday night, and I'm getting the book to both of them. A great book to give to a Jewish friend. I can't wait to get into the hands of Lubavitchers. In fact, I already sent it to one of their rabbis. But a great book for a Christian or someone that's struggling and wondering, it'll be a real, real faith builder. And then when we talk about how the resurrection changed the whole world, changed world history, it's one of those things, you know, he's alive and shout about it.
Well, when we come back in hour two with you, I want to get into more of this. This is, hey, what is more important than the resurrection of Jesus? I can't think of anything right now. So stick around, folks. We'll be back.
I never said I was a victim of circumstance. I still belong. Don't get me wrong. You can speak your mind. You want a love to last forever. One that will never fade away. I want to help you.
Hey, folks, welcome back. This is a special bunker edition, as you already know, of the Eric Metaxas Show. A couple of quick announcements. We want you to go to our YouTube page. It's the Eric Metaxas Show YouTube page. We're posting this video of David Benham. I would love you to share that video with as many people as you can. It's an important call to action. I don't ask this often. Go to the YouTube page of the Eric Metaxas Show and the David Benham interview that I do, 20 minutes. Please share that with as many people as possible. Also, again, Mike Lindell of MyPillow has been seriously attacked. He is a hero. He is a patriot. He is a friend. He is a brother in Christ. And I just want to say, if you're inclined ever to buy anything from him, do it now to encourage him. Make sure you use our discount code, Eric, to get our savings. But I just want to say, when somebody's being a hero, I want to support them. So David Benham, Mike Lindell, there are a number of wonderful people out there. Thanks to Ted Cruz for supporting the Benham brothers and what they're doing and the cause of life. And I guess I also ought to mention, you know, this week, all week long, I was going to be doing Bonhoeffer stuff, but it's kind of weird. We're doing these videos, and it's hard to promote Bonhoeffer. This is the 75th anniversary of his death. But what I should do is remind folks that as of this week, I have a new book out. It is called Seven More Men. In it, I tell the stories of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Billy Graham, George Whitefield, George Washington Carver, Sergeant Alvin York, General William Booth of the Salvation Army, Martin Luther. These are heroic stories. And I want to say that, you know, whenever I put a new book out, I don't do it lightly. I don't, you know, it's not like I have nothing else to do. I think heroes are really, really important in our time, whether they are modern day heroes like my friends Mike Lindell and David Benham, or whether they're heroes from the past. And so so many people said to me after I wrote Seven Men and Seven Women, you've got to write more. Aren't there more? And I thought, well, yes, there are tons more. So I've written seven more men. We're going to be working on seven more women this year. But Seven More Men is now out. You can get a copy. Obviously, I recommend it. I stand behind every word since I actually wrote every word, and I care about these heroes. But Seven More Men is the new book. We're doing a special giveaway where if you make a video of yourself, it can be up to 77 seconds long. And you put the video out there, use the hashtag We Need Heroes and the hashtag Eric Metaxas, and send it to info@ericmetaxas.com just to show us what you've done. Whichever of these videos gets the most, you know, comments and retweets or shares or whatever it is, you will win a free copy of this book. And I also have to say, and I think this is kind of important, when you do this, you need to tell in the video who a special hero is for you. It could be someone from history, or it could be your dad or granddad or uncle or anybody, any hero in your life, a coach, whatever it is, or a hero from history. It has to be short. So 77 seconds max. If it's 78 seconds, it's disqualified. I'm just telling you right now. So we're giving away seven free books each week. So it starts now. So you have to go. You have to post it. You have to do hashtag We Need Heroes, hashtag Eric Metaxas, and send it also to info@ericmetaxas.com. Whichever seven of these videos get the most, you know, retweets and shares and comments and all that kind of stuff, we will send you a free copy of my new book, Seven More Men. We're out of time. God bless you. Thanks for listening. I don't care.